are about to experience Jackson Snyder Presents. Produced by the Vero Asin Yahad, a Hebrew Nation radio original. That's jspresents.org. Please support Hebrew Nation Radio. Building a nation, not a denomination.
The New Testament Code by Robert Eisenman, the book of over 1,000 pages, not including the endnotes. This book is probably the hardest book that was ever written to read, except maybe the phone book. But I would almost venture to say there are as many characters in this book as there are in the phone book of a small town. And when I started reading Eisenman back in probably about 90, 88, something like that, I realized that I would read through a chapter and I would get nothing out of it. Why? Because I didn't know the characters or the literature that he was talking about. So what I did was I collected the literature myself. This was before the internet, so it was difficult to find some of the stuff, but in the process of finding it, I did find the Nazarene Acts, which at that time was very difficult to find. You couldn't get it, but in a rare books library or something like that, or if you bought a set of Apostolic Fathers. I began to study this literature and study the history as well. That's the second thing. There's not much more history we have from this time besides Josephus and a little bit of Tacitus or Tacitus, the Roman historian, that's really good. Both Josephus and Tacitus, they read almost novelistically. They're very, very interesting, as well as for the emperors, is Suetonius, the Nine Caesars, I think is the name of the book. Suetonius really digs deep for gossip on these emperors and tells us unabashedly what these emperors were known for. The Roman Empire and Israel are very, very much connected. We remember that Israel was under Lives of the 12 Caesars. Thank you. You know everything. Very connected in that the Roman Empire, especially its higher class people, were Greekophiles, Hellenists. They admired Greece, their history, their philosophy so much that the Roman Empire at its head aped or tried to be what Greece was in a little different way. Greece and their empires had pretty much dwindled by the time of Roman power. And Greece, you remember, had taken over Palestine somewhere around 300 BC. And it kept Palestine as a colony to about, I think, 60 BC, long time, 240 years or more. And in that time, the philosophy of the Greeks was to assimilate, just like the Borg collective. Assimilate. Alexander the Great went through the world in a very short time and conquered it, including the Persian Empire. And his means of assimilating was very simple. Either you become Greeks or you die, one thing or the other, including in Palestine. There was no quarter for Jews. We read a little about it in the Maccabees later on. But the whole idea behind Greece, and then later the Greek Empire called the Seleucid Empire that included Syria, their leaders were very interested in consolidating their property as Hellenistic Greek people. And so people are pretty astounded when I say that in the first century, the time of Yahshua, the Romans had taken over by this time, of course, and Roman infiltration was very similar to Greek infiltration. They're surprised when I say that probably undoubtedly the majority of people in Galilee spoke Greek. That was the main language. We even see that in the disciples of Yahshua. You've got Peter, Andrew, Philip, maybe a few more. They've got Greek names and probably were Hellenists that wanted to get back to their Hebrew roots again. Now, we had Hellenistic Jews They didn't worship Yahweh except in a very light way. They worshiped Greek gods. They spoke Greek. They read Greek literature, those that could read. And this was what was expected of them. Then, when Rome came in, it was the same thing with them. You can speak Greek because the Romans all spoke Greek. Pilate spoke Greek, even though his main language was Latin. That was part of your instruction growing up, was in the Greek language throughout the Roman Empire, most of which had belonged to Greece before that anyway. So that was the lingua franca of the day, and maybe Judea was the exception. They probably still spoke Hebrew to some extent, Aramaic, but Greek was, because it was the international language, if you wanted to do business, you had to speak Greek or Latin. It always made me wonder, when Yahshua stands before Pilate, or he stands before the Herodians, what language they spoke in. Certainly, governors of Syria, and Syria was part of the Greek Empire and then the Roman Empire, and was the had the capital at, let's see, Ctesiphon was the name of the town of Palestine, and certainly the government officials all spoke Greek, as did the telones, the tax farmers, like one we talk about from the New Testament named Matityahu, a man with a very Hebrew name who collected taxes, probably for Rome. These guys had a horrible reputation for gaining from the people up and above what the tax was, because that's how they got paid. And they were relentlessly punished by Greece and then later Rome if they didn't get their taxes in. So we see this picture of Matityahu and Yahshua sitting at the table with tax collectors and sinners. Tax collectors were the lowest form of life that there was at that time. Indeed, telones really means tax farmers rather than tax collectors. Don't get them confused with the IRS today. I mean, the IRS will get you eventually, but they won't flog you at any rate. They'll store you in jail. Eisenman begins his preface in order to do some defining of where he's coming from, primarily in names and places. So I'm going to go through as much of the preface as I can at this time, because if you don't have down pretty much the basic teachings of the preface, you're going to have a very hard time through the book. Eisenman points out the discovery. By the way, if you have something to say, unmute your mic and say it. That will be fine. Or click the button that says raise your hand. Eisenman starts out with the discovery of the gospel of Judas, saying that this gospel points to a later evolutionary development in gospel writing, an evolution of the canonical gospel literature. And not only that, but especially the writings of Paul and Paul's gospel. Paul's gospels, we believing that the canonical gospels had been rewritten by Pauline forces, and Paul himself has a gospel of Jesus Christ, Jesus Christos, that is in quite a bit of contradiction to what we would imagine the historical Jesus would be like. Paul's is a spiritual Jesus. Paul talks very little about Jesus' actual biography. He mentions the names of, he mentions Jesus' brothers or the brothers of the Lord, as he says, but the only historical information we get from him, except the name, Jesus Christos, is that he was crucified. And even Pilate isn't mentioned in that. He's crucified and he becomes, through the crucifixion, a redeemed man, a spiritual being that's able to ascend and descend at will. The Gospel of Judas points to almost the fullness of the evolution of those Gospels. I'll tell you a little bit about it. Take the Gospel of John, for instance, extremely anti-Semitic. Understand that I'm not talking from, I can compartmentalize. I'm not talking from a faith perspective. I'm talking from a historical critical perspective at this point. My faith doesn't have anything to do with explaining Eisenman's work, believe me. I think probably people of great faith that can't compartmentalize are going to have a very difficult time with this book. So we have an evolution, Eisenman points out, of anti-Semitism toward what was called in ancient times Gnosticism, and in the Gospel of Judas, fully developed Gnosticism. This comes from a reading of the canonical Gospels in regards to this Judas, Iscariot. We understand that Iscariot means the assassin man, the Sakari of the first century, especially late first century AD, were assassins, murderers. You probably already know this. They carried a little bit of a sickle-shaped knife, in which they would sneak up behind Roman officials and temple employees and cut their throats in crowds and then walk away. Or if they heard somebody speaking about the Torah, they would force them to be circumcised right then and there. That was it. Or they would kill them. Now, Judas Iscariot, Yehuda Iscariot, I got to tell you one thing. My name is a European offspring of Cariot. My name's Snyder. Cariot means cutter, and so does my name in German or Yiddish. That's a little bit scary. Maybe I'm of the blood of Judas, but that's a theological issue that we can take up sometime. And my redemption cometh nigh. The antagonist in the Gospel of John, who is selling out the Messiah for a certain amount of money and ends up throwing the money down at the temple steps. And further on in the Gospel of Luke, he hangs himself when his guts fall out. It's kind of cool to read the other accounts of what happened to Judas, one of the early Nazarenes in the late first century talks about Judas living on and swelling up. He got swelled up so bad that a chariot hit him, and he exploded where the chariot hit him. And this guy writes that even in his day, nobody goes around that alley anymore because it smells so bad. That's an interesting, interesting end to Judas Sakari. And we have another source that tells us that Judas ended up in Helvetia. And he died up in Helvetia, that's Switzerland, you know, and can't get into how he got up there. But that's another legend that comes from Judas Iscariot, if he was even historical. Most consider him a fictional stand-in for the Jewish nation and for the contempt that the gospel redactors heaped upon the Jews. He stands for the whole Jewish nation as the protagonist in the Gospels and the murderer of the Messiah. But consider this Judas to be a stand-in for the entire nation of Jews, portrayed as the assassin. The whole Jewish world in the Gospel, according to this view, is found in the reprehensible acts of Judas Iscariot, his greed, his money grubbing, his love of unrighteous mammon. By the time we get to the Gospel of Judas, he's elevated. He's no longer simply a Jew. He's the greatest of the Jews. And not only is the greatest of the Jews, that he's able to exit Judaism altogether because he has the secret knowledge. He's the purveyor of gnosis in the Gospel of Judas, and thus transcends the whole Jewish nation that he represented in the canonical Gospels. No Jews could come close to him. Even the holy ones of the canonical Gospels, that is, the disciples, they could never attain to the place where Judas attained. Thus, Judas is no longer a part of the Jewish world in the Gospel of Judas, but has, as the assassin of Jesus, become more than a man himself. He becomes the redeemer of Jesus, causing the redemption of Jesus by assassinating him in this Gnostic kind of thinking. A good Gnostic who had attained to the secret knowledge in order to go up to the highest heaven and be able to encounter the archons, that is, evil angels that were against him, and answer questions that they might pose to him, and going from one archon to the other as he ascends up, fulfill the mysteries of Gnosis and end up in the Pleroma, the great place of the dwelling of the Most High, indescribable God of light and love. So in Gnosticism, you've got to understand that one with a secret knowledge can only begin his journey up when wretched Windows Update, when he is murdered, when he's martyred. So he martyrs Jesus in order to redeem him. That's a good thing. And Judas, in the Gospel of Judas, is awaiting to be martyred, thus redeemed himself by the disciples. He has a dream. A lot is missing from the Gospel of Judas, but we got enough to see that his dream is, his redemption is nigh, because the other disciples, who could never attain to this kind of knowledge, these ignorant, sinful disciples, are going to stone him. And indeed, that is, we reckon, how Judas ascends, by the stoning of the disciples, leading to his death, leading to his rising. So he is, in the Gospel of Judas, awaiting its own redemption at the hands of these chosen Jews that John considers chosen in his gospel, that is, the disciples. We see something a little different in Mark. Mark always shows the disciples as ignorant cowards, afraid. In fact, the Gospel of Mark ends up in 16:8, and they were afraid. We go to now a little different vignette, that is, the Platonists or Platonists, those that followed the philosophies of Plato. Plato was a student, was the teacher of Socrates. Socrates was the student. Try it again. Plato was the teacher of Socrates. Socrates was the teacher of Aristotle. Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander of Macedon, that is, Alexander the Great. Plato never really wrote anything. What was written was by Socrates, who wrote down the teachings of Plato. And then we have the greatest of them all, Aristotle. You remember what happened to Socrates? Socrates and his wife, Xantippe, X-A-N, Xantippe. Well, Socrates ended up getting an ultimatum that he could make a choice as to the ultimatum, and he had to redeem himself. He had to kill himself. So he commits hari kari and leaves Aristotle behind. Aristotle wrote all kinds of works of philosophy, religion, geography, history, all kinds of stuff that was lost to us until the Muslims, I should say, till Islam was able to conquer that area of the world. And at that time, Islam was very open to learnings, and they took the works of Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and they translated them into Arabic, from which they were translated into Latin, and thus got into the hands of the church fathers of, let me see, about the 12th century, I believe, especially St. Thomas Aquinas. And we talk about Constantine perverting Christianity. Well, what Constantine did was just a drop in the bucket compared to Aquinas. And these people of the Catholic faith at that time took Aristotle and made him a proto-evangelist. That before Jesus came along, Aristotle had the news on Jesus and projected that news. And unfortunately, that's why we in the church today have the teachings of body, soul, and spirit, heaven and hell, and many other ones. In the first century, we have Platonists that were incorporated in Judaism. You got to know that if so many in Palestine spoke Greek, even more in Egypt, because Egypt was another protectorate of Greece called the Ptolemaic Empire, starting with a P. And we have there Philo and his counterpart in Israel, whose name was Paul. Paul and Philo. And we might throw Josephus into the bunch too, because Josephus became a lover of Latin and scion of royalty, the Roman Empire, all of those would consider the story of Judas not history, but literature, and specifically allegory, or in the case of Philo, enigma, that the historical part could only be read in between the lines, especially in the case of Philo, using a certain code that Philo created in order to find what's behind the text, the real historical meaning behind the stories that were in texts like the Gospels. Now, I did a couple teachings on the Philoan enigmas to show you in one case how Philo would have worked to interpret Gospel passages in a historical way rather than just as they're read. Those are out at jspresents.org, or I believe that I have them linked in the link that I sent out there. I'll see if it's still out there on chat. Yes, you'll find a link out there, jacksonsnyder.com/newtestamentcompreface.doc. That's links to everybody I'm mentioning here, if you want to go out and look there. The Philoan enigmas, a way of interpreting allegories. And as you can see from the Gospels themselves, they are very much novelized, especially John, and especially Acts and Luke, more than the rest. Got to be reading between the lines, got to understand the name games that they have, the other historical games, again, as I said before a number of times, that authors of such literature, when they wrote about criminals, like the Messianic dynasty, they chanced being arrested and executed because the Roman law at that time was, you write about these guys, you get caught, you get the same punishment as they do. Now, these accounts of the Gospels are considered to be literature to them. One of our speeches by Robert Eisenman that I have out there on the download site addresses in almost genius fashion the difference between literature and history. Literature will win the hearts and minds of people. History will never do that. So I have so much trouble when we talk about Revelation as history, because speculative, novelistic literature interpretations of Revelation are certainly more affecting the mind than the historical facts of the situation. Therefore, we don't know how we would ever overcome the, brainwashing of people through the Christian church as to the proclamation of the Revelation of John. Literature wins hearts and minds, not history. Professor Eisenman seems to be a master of applying the methodology of Philo and others, look at the name of the book, New Testament Code, to get to some startling truths or speculations behind that ancient literature. Let me find my next page here. Paul, on the other hand, exemplifies his philosophical underpinnings, especially in Galatians 4:24. I'm sure you all know what that passage has to say. It compares the Tanakh, or maybe more appropriately, the Torah, to Hagar, which is an extremely derogatory, anti-Jewish synthesis, very anti-Semitic, demonstrative. It shows Paul's method of integrating allegorically. But for Paul, his allegory is to be interpreted by you as history and truth.
It's time for our break for some very important announcements. And while you're listening to the announcements, Commander Lee and I are going to the bowling alley. Catch you on the other side. Lee and I are back with Jackson Snyder Presents, and I'm happy to announce that we had time for one game where Lee rolled an exceptional 59 and I came in second at 32. I love bowling.
Because in his mind, it is truth. Galatians is certainly the most revealing document of all those considered to be sacred, Galatians 4:24. Now, Philo, on the other hand, would have interpreted this in the framework of Egypt rather than Palestine or Hellenism. Now, Egypt was Hellenistic, but it was of a little different brand there. The interpretation that Philo would have done concerning Messiah or even Judas Iscariot would be in the framework of Egyptian God-man stories, men that became gods or men that ascended. And today we have something called ascended masters in certain movements, that the ascended masters who were men come back down to give people messages like the Essene Gospel of Peace, like the Gospel of the Holy Twelve, totally channeled from dead people, or, if you please, spirits of the ascended masters. What affected the church so much was the philosopher, theologian called, I got him down on my paper there, Anselm, Why the God-Man is the name of his essay, something we were encouraged to read in the university in regards to religious study and the nature of Christ. Why the God-Man? So I've got a link to that wiki page where it'll give you a link to the essay. It's certainly worth reading. I would say most Christians would agree with it. I doubt that you would. In Egypt, Egypt was full of God-man stories that are exemplified in the Coptic gospel literature, unlike the Hebrew Bible, where the framework is different, in which God has interests in the doings of humankind, and the deity itself is moving in a spiritual way to help people or hinder people. The Egyptian way is that God becomes a human being, or gods become human-like beings. Consider the kingdom days of Egypt and look at some of the Egyptian gods like Thoth, who some say is still speaking today, every kind of heresy, and people are believing it. They are in human form with some kind of an animal head or wings to portray themselves as those who are able to ascend and descend. This is not part of the Hebrew understanding. The Hebrew understanding before apocalypticism is that Yahweh's angel dwells among men and can take the form of man, but is not a man. This is very much like some passages in the Gospels where Yahshua has some form of deity. Yahshua is a divine holy man, but not God in person, come down and become like man, not a person becoming fully the substance of the creator of the universe. That really puts one into some logical dilemmas. If you really think it through in your mind, what it means if Jesus is God and God comes down that way and God is no longer in the heavenlies, that Jesus dies and God dies, and what about the raising? If they're the same substance, we believe they've got the same person, but not the same substance. That's more Hebraic thinking rather than men that came down from the skies as gods to walk among human beings and command them. That's a Gnostic way. The deity itself in those kinds of understandings is walking on earth as incarnated as a man, being killed, redeemed, that is, and then descending back into the sky. Well, there are some places in the New Testament that we could cite, and I think I did one on the notes there, where that kind of thinking is pretty prevalent. In the Gnostic stuff of Egypt, it's very prevalent in just about every book, say, from the Nag Hammadi Coptic collection. Next, we go to a new vignette. We're going to go to Herodians. We're going through the preface of the New Testament cult. If you don't know the players, if you don't know the program, you're never going to be able to speculate what happens. Let's talk about Herodians. Herodians were Idumeans. Idumeans at one time were brought into the collective of people called Jews, because Idumea was just south of Jerusalem, and the religion caught fire down there at one time or the other. But in the time of the first century, they were considered half-Jews, not fully Jews, and Idumeans, by and large, didn't keep Torah, but Idumeans were on hand when the Jewish war broke out, and actually the Revelation speaks to some extent of the Idumeans that came up to try to help the Zealots and Sicarii in Jerusalem fight off the Romans. And what happened there? There was a great earthquake. The city split in three, etc. That's all about Herodians, especially Herodians with the surname Agrippa, just for instance. We're going to talk about Agrippa for a while. That is King Agrippa and his family. The Agrippa Idumeans, half-Jews, were named after Marcus Agrippa, who was not an Idumean or a Nabataean. Marcus Agrippa, that Eisenman has kind of an idea that the name Marcus became the name of that supposedly earliest gospel, that Mark took his name from Marcus Agrippa, and the family of Herods took the name Agrippa as well. This Agrippa, Marcus Agrippa, was a great general. He was a great favorite of Caesar Augustus or Octavian. He was the general that beat Antony and Cleopatra at the Battle of Actium. Herodians at that time always had two names, maybe three names at times. These Idumeans were brought up in the luxury of Rome. They were brought up in palaces. I'm talking about all the Herods after Antipater, the Herod that worked for Rome and worked his way up, and from him came Herod the Great, and then all the different sons, most of which were murdered by Herod the Great himself, and the offsprings of his sister Salome, of which Paul was one of them. They were brought up in Rome, in the temple, with emperors, because they were important to the empire, because Idumea was a territory that was very specifically and well located in order to keep control of the entire place that we call the Holy Land, Syria. Especially Herod Agrippa. As a youth, he was friends with the Emperor Caligula. They were really good buddies, took trips together and did leisurely things together. And you can look up Caligula, you'll find quite an insane guy there. Became emperor because he was able to smother Tiberius, the former emperor, and his uncle after being sexually abused for years and years on the Isle of Goats, the Isle of Capri. The Agrippas, the Herod Agrippas, Agrippa number one and Agrippa number two, historically had very close connections with Egypt. We're still talking about Egypt. There was a huge contingency of Jews and soon after Christians in Egypt. Again, it seemed like there was a lot more affluence in Egypt, and there was also a temple of Yahweh in Egypt, the Orion Temple, which I'm talking about on my lectures on Melchizedek. It started last week. We'll do it again Friday. I'm going to talk everything Melchizedek, everything I know, which is a lot. I've studied him for a long time, trying to debunk some of these teachings on Melchizedek now that are nothing but hindering believers in their faith and turning them back to Christianity. So the important connections here between the Herod Agrippas and the contingency of Jews in Egypt and their philosophical leaders, which Egypt itself later on was nearly wiped out by the Messianic movement. That is, in Trajan's time, about 117 AD, there was a big Christian revolt there. They'd been treated so bad by both Jews and pagans that the Christians raised themselves up and started burning down the city. This is, again, in the time of the Emperor Trajan. I've got a link to him there, too. Nearly wiped out everybody. Seems like Eisenman's making connection here with the gospel, especially Marcus Agrippa, with all the Agrippas, and an Egyptian triumvirate that had unforeseen consequences of internecine strife strife between Egyptians with different beliefs and war, and finally the destruction of Alexandria and its library up there. Egypt was a prolific manufacturer of gospel-type literature. Thank you.
Schneider, do you know where you are going for the tabernacle feast this year?
Brother Shrimkoff, why are you asking me that? You know where I'm going. I'm going to be with the Vero Essen Yahad on the top of Goshen Mountain in Tennessee.
Oh, I was thinking of going to the Singles Tabernacles there in Alabama.
Really? Well, sir, up on the top of the mountain, you're going to see all kinds of wildlife. Fellowship with your Yahad friends, do some supervised ministry, learn all about biblical subjects that are important to you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Plus, you've got Nashville just up the road if you want to go there and have you some kosher food. And you've got all these little towns around. I know how you like to go junking.
Oh, yeah. I really like to find, like, old coffee pots, bun warmers, and bananas at a place where they have all kinds of junk.
Oh, that's not junk. I mean, these things are important to a lot of people. Anyway, we're going to have Sukkot October 3rd through 12th in Hohenwald, Tennessee.
You're going to charge me a fortune?
You know we never do that. $75 for a bed in a cabin, all you can eat? Think of it, Shroomy. Mountain springs bubbling right outside your window. Walking trails, right? Through little dribbling, bubbling brooks, and all the birds singing off the grid.
Oh, you mean drones? I can't get up there.
No way. And besides, who do you know at the single Sukkot?
Oh, I really don't know anybody. I just thought maybe I could get a date. That's why you go to a single Sukkot.
Well, don't miss the fun. Sukkot with us on Goshen Mountaintop, Hohenwald, Tennessee, October 3rd through 12th. And it'll only cost you $75 for 9 days of lodging and food. Youth programs, too. I was hoping that you would be a youth instructor.
I suppose I could do that, but really the only sports I know is Dutch cheese ball.
Well, it is enough. For more information, surf to veroyahad.org, fill out the registration form, and we'll see you in October.
Can I bring my pet to Jumbo?
Well, what do you say about that, Jumbo?
Uh-uh.
Here's an excerpt of an interview I had with Professor Eisenman last year, in which he talks about literature and history, the difference, and what is literature as opposed to history in the Acts of the Apostles. Professor Eisenman speaks of the we section of the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 17 and on, and regarding the source of that information.
We document. It's been a sentence in the first person that it came from a diary of some kind. And, okay, for lack of a better person, one assumes maybe it's Luke's diary. But the point is, it's an historical document, and it reads totally different than the rest of Acts. There are no miraculous materials in it. It just is down to earth. We did this. We did that. We went here. Some conversation reports the final trip that they take up to Jerusalem. It records the confrontation between Paul and James. It's so unique that James hasn't even been introduced in the previous part of Acts. Well, that's why I say that's a historical document. So from the end of Acts 15 on to the end, being a little bit careful if some third-person material hasn't crept in there, you can say that's a pretty historical document. And that final confrontation between Paul and James blows your mind. You see, Paul, we are mostly zealots here. What? Did we ever heard that the early Christian community were mostly zealots? That's in Acts. And they have heard that you teach against the law, against this place, and against the temple, and so, and against the people in all the cities of Asia. Well, that is an incredible accusation. An incredible accusation, even for Acts. So we know we're in the realm of historical material here. And it's most quite mind-blowing historical material. That's what I mean by historical document. The other historical document is, of course, guess who? Josephus. Now, with Josephus, even though it's a fairly historical document and it has had some interpolation here and there and has had a transmission history different in different places, for the most part, it's not only dependable, it's almost encyclopedic, which is quite an incredible thing. I mean, since he wrote two or three works, which is really amazing that they were conserved. You have the antiquities, you have the war, and so on. Well, the war is limited to that one small chunk of material, but the antiquities covers a huge swath of materials, and then you have the Vita, etc. So you have a lot of Josephus material, but Josephus is different. You have to correct for his point of view. You have to correct for his side of the struggle he's on. First, he says he's a Pharisee. He seems to have spent time out in the wilderness with, you know, a person like John the Baptist, if not John the Baptist. He seems to probably therefore have been at the settlement we all now call Qumran. He's not happy with that group. He leaves that group. Maybe he was expelled. In any event, he knows a lot about them. And when he describes Essenes, very careful, because what his Essenes are more like Pharisees, and they're not the Essenes of the literature at Qumran. So you have to also be very careful with Josephus. Even though we have historical material, we have a point of view, we have someone who's into disinformation, he has a point of view into disinformation, and that is on the Pharisee side, collaborating side of the struggle with the Romans, even though he recounts that he had been involved in this Vita, in defending and even commanding the defense of settlements in Galilee, etc.
You have been listening to Jackson Snyder Present, and we will continue this discussion in our next segment. Shalom, shalom. Thank you for listening.